Bubbles says I must have a city of worms living up my bum, but that ain't it. I've a secret, if you won't tell anyone.
Go on, lad. I'm hardly paying attention.
What about him?
He nodded to Drool, who was sitting in the corner petting one of the castle cats.
Drool, I called, is Taster's secret safe with you?
As dim as a snuffed candle, he is, said the git, in my voice. Telling a secret to Drool is like casting ink in the night sea.
See there, said I.
Well, said Taster, looking around as if anyone would want to be in our miserable company.
I'm sick a lot.
Of course you are. It's the bloody Dark Ages. Everyone has the plague or the pox. It's not like you're leprous and dropping fingers and toes like rose petals, is it?
No, not sick like that. I just vomit nearly every time I eat.
So, you're a little chunder monkey. Not to worry, Taster. You keep it down long enough for it to kill you, don't you?
I reckon.
He nibbled at a stuffed date. Duty done, then. All's well that ends well. But back to my concerns. Do you think France and Burgundy are puffed us, or are they, you know, just fucking French?
I've never even seen them,
Taster said. Oh, quite right. What about you, Drool?
Drool? Stop that!
Drool pulled the damp kitten out of his mouth.
But it were licking me first. You said it was only proper manners.
I was talking about something completely different. Put the cat down. The heavy door creaked open, and the Earl of Kent slipped into the room, as stealthy as a church bell rolling downstairs. Kent's a broad-shouldered bull of a fellow, and while he moves with great strength for his grandfather years, grace and subtlety remain blushing virgins in his retinue.
There you are, boy.
What boy? Said I. I see no boy here. True, I only stand to Kent's shoulder, and it would take two of me and a suckling pig to balance him on a scale, but even a fool requires some respect, except from the king, of course.
Fine, fine. I just wanted to tell you not to make sport of feebleness nor age tonight. The king's been brooding all week about his crawling unburdened to the grave. I think it's the weight of his sins.
Well, if you weren't so dog-fuckingly old, there would be no temptation toward mirth, would there?
Not my fault, that.
Kent grinned, then.
Pocket, you would not willfully hurt your master.
Aye, Kent, and with Goneril and Regan and their lords in the hall, there'd be no need to jest geriatric. Is that why the king has kept company only with you this week, brooding upon his years? He hasn't been planning on marrying off Cordelia, then?
He's spoken of it, but only as part of his entire legacy, of property and history. He seemed set on a course to hold the kingdom steady when I last left him. He bade me leave while he gave private audience to the bastard Edmund.
He's talking to Edmund? Alone?
Aye, the bastard drew on his father's years of service for the favour.
I must go to the king. Kent, stay here with Drool, if you would. There's food and drink to hold you. Taster, show good Kent the best of those dates.
Taster?
Taster. Drool, shake Taster. He appears to have fallen asleep.
Fanfare sounded then. A single anemic trumpet. The other three trumpeters having recently succumbed to herpes. A sore on the lip is as bad as an arrow in the eye to a trumpeter. The Chancellor had them put down. Or maybe they'd just been made drummers. They weren't blowing bloody fanfare, that's all I'm saying.
Drool put down his kitten and climbed to his feet.
With grave offence to daughters three, alas, the king a fool shall be, said the giant in a lilting female voice.
Where did you hear that, Drool? Who said that?
Pretty,
said Drool, massaging the air with his great meaty paws, as if caressing a woman's breasts.
Time to go, said Kent. The old warrior threw open the door into the hall.
They stood all around the great table, round after the tradition of some long-forgotten king. The centre opened to the floor where servants served, orators orated, and Drool and I performed. Kent took his place near the king's throne. I stood with some yeomen to the side of the fire and motioned for Drool to find a place to hide behind one of the stone pillars that supported the vault. Fools do not have a place at the table. Most times I served at the foot of the king, providing quips, criticisms, and brilliant observations through the meal, but only after he had called for me. Leah had not called for a week. He came into the room, head up, scowling at each of his guests, until his eye lit on Cordelia and he smiled. He motioned for everyone to sit, and they did.
"Edmund," said the king, "fetch the princes of France and Burgundy."
Edmund bowed to the king and backed toward the main entrance of the hall, then looked to me, winked, and motioned for me to come join him. Dread rose in my chest like a black serpent. What had the bastard done? I should have cut his throat when I had the chance. I sidled down the side wall, the bells on the tips of my shoes conspicuously unhelpful in concealing my movement. The king looked to me, then away, as if the sight of me might cause rot on his eye. Once through the door, Edmund pulled me roughly aside. The big yeoman at the threshold lowered the blade of his halberd an inch and frowned at the bastard. Edmund released me and looked bewildered, as if his own hand had betrayed him. I bring food and drink to the guards when they are on post during feasts. I believe it is written in the obfuscations of St. Pesto. In 9 cases out of 10, a large friend with a poleaxe shall truly a blessing be. "What have you wrought, bastard?" I whispered with great fury and no little spit. "Only what you wanted, fool. Your princess will have no husband, that I can assure. But even your sorceries won't keep you safe if you reveal my strategy."
"My sorceries? What?"
"Oh, the ghost."
"Yes, the ghost, and the bird. When I was crossing the battlement, a raven called me a tosser and shat on my shoulder."
"Right. My minions are everywhere," said I. "And you're right to fear my canny mastery of the heavenly orbs and command of spirits and what not. But lest I unleash something unpleasant upon you, tell me, what did you say to the king?" Edmund smiled then, which I found more unsettling than his blade.
"I heard the princesses speaking amongst themselves about their affections for their father earlier in the day, and was enlightened to their character. I merely hinted to the king that he might ease his burden with the same knowledge."
"What knowledge?"
"Go find out, fool. I'm off to fetch Cordelia's suitors." And he was away. The guard held the door, and I slipped back into the hall and to a spot near the table. The king, it seemed, had only then finished a roll call of sorts, naming each of his friends and family at court, proclaiming his affection for each, and in the cases of Kent and Gloucester, recalling their long history of battles and conquests together. Bent, white-haired, and slight is the king, but there is a cold fire in his eye still. His visage puts one in mind of a hunting bird, fresh unhooded and set for its kill.
"I am old, and my burdens of responsibility and property weigh heavily on me. So to avoid conflict in the future, I propose to divide my kingdom among younger strengths now, so I may crawl to the grave light of heart."
"What better than a light-hearted grave crawl?"
I said softly to Cornwall, villainous twat that he is.
I crouched between him and his Duchess Regan. Princess Regan, tall, fair, raven-haired, with a weakness for plunging red velvet gowns and another for rascals. Both grievous faults had they not played out so pleasurably for this teller of tales.
"Oh, Pocket, did you get the stuffed dates I sent you?"
Regan asked. "And generous to a fault as well."
"Shh, bunny cunny," I shushed. "Father is speaking."
Cornwall drew his dagger, and I moved along the table to Goneril's side.
Leah went on.
"These properties and powers I will divide between my sons-in-law, the Duke of Albany and the Duke of Cornwall, and that suitor who takes the hand of my beloved Cordelia. But so I may determine who shall have the most bounteous share, I ask of my daughters. Which of you loves me most? Goneril, my eldest born, speak first."
"No pressure, pumpkin," I whispered. "I have this fool."
She snapped.
And with a great smile, and no little grace, she made her way around the outside of the table and to the opening at the centre, bowing to each of the guests as she went. She is shorter, and rather more round than her sisters, more generously padded in bosom and bustle, her eyes a grey sky short of emerald, her hair a yellow sun short of ginger. Her smile falls on the eye like water on the tongue of a thirst-mad sailor.
I slid into a chair. "A handsome creature is she," I said to the Duke of Albany. That one breast, the way it juts a bit to the side when she's naked, I mean. Does that bother you at all? Make you wonder what it's looking at over there? Bit like a wall-eyed man you think is always talking to someone else.
Hush, fool, Albany said.
He is nearly a score years older than Goneril. Goatish and dull, methinks, but somewhat less of a scoundrel than the average noble. I do not loathe him. Mind you, it's obviously part of the pair, not some breast errant off on a quest of its own. I like a bit of asymmetry in a woman. Makes me suspicious when nature's too even-handed, fearful symmetry and all. But it's not like you're shagging a hunchback or anything. I mean, once she's on her back, it's hard to get either one of them to look you in the eye, isn't it? Shut up! Barked Goneril, having turned her back on her father, which one is never supposed to do, in order to scold me. Bloody clumsy etiquette, that. Sorry, go on, said I, waving her on with Jones, who jingled gaily. Sir, she addressed the king, I love you more than words can say. I love you more than eyesight, space, and liberty. I love you beyond anything that can be valued, rich or rare. No less than life itself, with grace, health, beauty, and honour. As much as any child or father has loved, so I love thee. A love that takes my breath away and makes me scarcely able to speak. I love you above all things, even pie. Oh, bollocks! Who had said it? I was relatively sure it was not my voice, as it hadn't come from the normal hole in my face, and Jones had been silent as well.
Cordelia?
I scooted out of Goneril's chair and scampered to the junior princess's side, staying low to avoid attention or flying cutlery.
Bloody buggering bollocks, said Cordelia.
Leah, refreshed from his shower of flowered bullshit, said,
What?
I stood then. Well, sirrah, lovable as thou art, the lady's profession strains credibility. It is no secret how much the bitch loves pie. I crouched again quickly.
Silence, fool! Chamberlain, bring me the map!
The distraction had worked. The king's ire had turned from Cordelia to me. She took the opportunity to poke me in the earlobe with a fork.
Ouch!
Whispered, yet emphatic.
Tart!
Knave!
Harpy!
Rodent!
Whore!
Whoremonger!
Do you have to pay to be a whoremonger? Because strictly speaking...
Shh!
She said, grinning. She poked me in the ear again, then nodded toward the king that we should pay attention. The king pointed to the map with a bejeweled dagger.
All these lands, from here to here, with rich farmlands, bounteous rivers and deep forests, I do grant to Goneril and her husband Albany, and to their offspring in perpetuity. Now, we must hear from our second daughter. Dearest Regan, wife to Cornwall, speak.
Regan made her way to the center floor, looking down at her older sister Goneril as she passed, as if to say, I'll show you. She raised her arms out to her sides, trailing the long velvet sleeves down to the floor, so she described the shape of a grand and bosomy crucifix. She looked to the ceiling, as if drawing inspiration from the heavenly orbs themselves, then pronounced,
What she said!
Huh?
Said the king, and verily, huh, was echoed round the room. Regan seemed to realize that she should probably go on.
My sister has expressed my thoughts exactly, as if she may have looked at my notes even before we here entered. Except, I love thee more. In the list of all senses, all falls short, and I'm touched by nothing but your love.
She bowed then, looking up a bit to see if anyone was buying it.
I'm going to be sick, said Cordelia, probably louder than was really necessary,
as were the coughing and gagging noises she perpetrated thereafter. Deflecting, I stood and said, She's been touched by a bit more than His Majesty's love, I dare say. I mean, in this very room I can name... The king shot me his best must-I-chop-off-your-head look, and I fell silent. He nodded and looked to the map.
To Regan and Cornwall I leave this third of the kingdom, no smaller or less valuable than that bestowed upon Goneril. Now... Cordelia, our joy, who is courted by so many eligible young nobles, What can you say to receive a third more opulent than your sister's?
Cordelia stood at her chair, not making her way to the middle of the room as her sisters had.
Nothing, she said.
Nothing? Asked the king.
Nothing.
You'll get nothing for nothing, said Lear. Speak again.
Well, you can't blame her, really, can you? I interjected. I mean, you've given all the good bits to Goneril and Regan, haven't you? What's left? A bit of Scotland rocky enough to starve a sheep, and this poxy river near Newcastle. I'd taken the liberty of going over to the map.
I'd say nothing is a fair start for bargaining.
You should counter with Spain, Majesty.
Now Cordelia moved to the centre of the room.
I'm sorry, Father, that I can't heave my heart into my mouth like my sisters. I love you according to my bond as a daughter. No more, no less.
Be careful what you say, Cordelia, said Lear. Your dowry is draining away with every word.
My lord, you have sired me, raised me, and loved me. I return those duties back, as is proper. I obey you, love you, and most honour you. But how can my sisters say they love you above all? They have husbands. Don't they have to reserve some love for them?
Yes, but have you met their husbands? Said I. There was growling from various points around the table. How can you call yourself a noble if you'll just start growling for no reason?
Uncivilized it is. When I shall marry, you can rest assured that my husband will get at least half my care and half my love as well. To say anything else, I'd be lying to you.
This was Edmund's doing, I was sure of it. Somehow he'd known that Cordelia would answer this way and had convinced the king to ask the question. And she did not know that her father had been wrestling with his own mortality and worth for the week. I hopped over to the princess and whispered,
"Lying now would be the better part of valour. Repent later. Throw the old gent a bone, lass."
"So, this is how you feel?" asked the king.
"Aye, my lord. It is."
"So young and so untender," said Lear.
"So young, my lord, and true," said Cordelia.
"So young and so bloody stupid," said the puppet Jones.
"Fine, child. So be it. Let your truth be your dowry, then. For by the radiance of the sun, the dark of the night, all the saints, the Holy Mother, the orbs of the sky, and nature herself, I disown you."
In his spirituality, Lear is, well, flexible. When pressed for a curse or a blessing, he will sometimes invoke gods from a half-dozen pantheons, just to be sure to catch the ear of whichever might be on watch that day.
"No property, land, or title shall be yours. Cannibals of darkest America who would sell their own young in the meat market shall be closer to me than you, my used-to-be daughter."
I wondered about that. No one had ever seen American, being as they are mythical. Legend goes that in the name of profit they did sell the limbs of their own children as food. That was before they burned the world, of course. Since I didn't expect a state visit from the merchant cannibals of the apocalypse any time soon, it appeared my liege was either herniating the metaphor or speaking the tongue of a frothing nutter. Kent stood then.
"My liege."
"Sit down, Kent,"
the king barked.
"Come not between the dragon and his wrath. I loved her the best, and hoped that she would take care of me in my dotage. But since she doesn't love me enough, only in the grave will there be peace for Lear."
Cordelia looked more confused than hurt.
"But, father..."
"Out of my sight. Where is France? Where is Burgundy? Finish this business. Goneril, Regan, your younger sister's share of the kingdom shall be divided between you. Let Cordelia marry her own pride. Cornwall and Albany shall divide the power and property of a king evenly. I shall retain only my title and enough of a stipend to maintain 100 knights and their carriers. You shall keep me from month to month in your own castles, but the kingdom shall be yours."
"Royal Lear, this is madness!"
Kent again, now making his way around the table to the center floor.
"Careful, Kent," said Lear. "The bow of my anger is bent. Don't make me loose the arrow." "Loose it if you must,
You'd kill me for being bold enough to tell you that you're mad. The best of loyalty is that a loyal man has the courage to speak plainly when his leader moves to folly.
Reverse your decision, sir.
Your youngest daughter doesn't love you least because she's quiet, any more than those who speak loudest are the most sincere.
The older sisters and their husbands were on their feet at that. Kent glared at them.
No more, Kent, the king warned. On your life, not another word.
What has my life ever been but a thing I risked in service for you, protecting you? Threaten my life as you will. It will not stop me from telling you that you do wrong, sir.
Leo started to draw his sword then, and I knew he had truly lost all sense of judgment if turning on his favourite daughter and closest advisor and friend hadn't shown it already. If Kent decided to defend himself, he'd go through the old man like a scythe through a wheat straw. It was unfolding too fast, even for a fool to stay the king's blade with wit. I could only watch. But Albany moved quickly down the table and stayed the king's hand, pushing his sword back down into the scabbard. Kent grinned then, the old bear, and I saw that he wouldn't have drawn blade on the old man at all. He would have died to make his point to the king. What's more, Leon knew it too, but there was no mercy in his eye, and the madness had gone cold. He shook himself free of Albany's grasp, and the duke backed away. When Leo spoke again, his voice was low, restrained, but palsied with hate.
"Hear me, thou traitorous ferret. No one challenges my authority, my decisions or my vows. To do so on British land is death, and in the rest of the known world is war. I'll not have it. Your years of service noted, I give you your life, but only your life, and never again in my sight. You have 5 days, Kent, to provision yourself, and on the 6th day, turn your back on our kingdom forever. If 12 days pass and you are still in the land, your life is forfeit. Now go. This is my decree, and it shall not be revoked."
Kent was shaken. This was not the blade he had braced for. He bowed then.
"Fare thee well, King. I go, for I dare to question a power so high that you give it away for a flattering tongue."
He turned to Cordelia then.
"Take heart, girl. You've spoken truly and done nothing wrong. May the gods protect you."
He turned on a heel, putting his back to the king, something I'd never seen him do before, and marched out, pausing only a second to look at Regan and Goneril.
"Well lied, you spiteful bitches."
I wanted to cheer the old brute, write a poem for him.
But the hall had fallen silent, and the sound of the great oaken door closing behind Kent echoed through the hall like the first thunder of a world-breaking storm.
"Well," said I, dancing to the middle of the floor, "I think that went about as well as could be expected."
Five. Pity the fool. Kent banished, Cordelia disinherited, the king, having given away his property and power, but most important, my home, the White Tower, the 2 older sisters insulted by Kent, the duke's ready to cut my throat. Well, getting a laugh might be a challenge. Royal succession, it seemed, would not be a prudent subject to broach, and I was lost for a transition to slapstick or pantomime after Leah's high drama. So drool was but a millstone on comedy's neck. I juggled apples and sang a little song about monkeys while I pondered the problem. The king was of late leaning decidedly pagan, while the elder sisters favoured the church. Gloucester and Edgar were devout to the Roman pantheon, and Cordelia, well, she thought the whole lot was shit, and England should have her own church with women in the clergy. Quaint. So the high-minded comedy of religious satire it would be. I tossed my apples around the table and said, 2 popes are shagging a camel behind a mosque, when this Saracen comes up and...
"There is only 1 true pope, shouted Cornwall, great tower of malignant smegma that he is.
"It's a jest, you wanker," said I. "Suspend fucking disbelief for a bit, would you?"
He was right in a way, although not for the purpose of the camel bit. For the last year, there had only been 1 pope, in the holy city of Amsterdam. But for the prior 50 years, there had been 2 popes, the retail pope and the discount pope. After the 13th Holy Crusade, when it was decided that to avoid future strife, the birthplace of Jesus would be moved to a different city every 4 years, holy shrines lost their geographical importance. There arose a great price war in the church, with shrines offering pilgrims dispensation at varying competitive rates. Now there didn't need to be a miracle declared on the spot. Anywhere could basically be declared a holy site, and often was. Lourdes would still sell dispensation coupons with the healing waters, but also some bloke in Pudding Ho could plant some pansies and hawk, "Jesus had a wee right on this very spot when he was a lad. 2 pennies and a spliff of Cardiff chronic will get you out of purgatory for an eon, mate." Soon a whole guild of low-priced shrine keepers around Europe named their own pope. Bold-faced, the relatively shameless discount pope of Prague. The price war was on. If the Dutch pope would give you 100 years out of purgatory for a shilling and a ferryman's ticket, the discount pope would let you out for 200 years and send you home with the femur of a minor saint and a splinter of the true cross. The retail pope would offer cheesy bacon toppings on the host with communion, and the discount pope would counter with topless nun night for midnight mass. It came to a head, though, when Saint Matthew appeared in a vision to the retail pope, telling him that the faithful were more interested in the quality of their religious experience, not just the quantity. Thus inspired, the retail pope moved Christmas to June when the weather wasn't so shit for shopping, and the discount pope, not realizing the game had changed, responded by forgiving hell altogether for anyone who gave a priest a handjob. Without hell, there was no fear. Without fear, there was no further need for the church to supply redemption, and more important, no means for the church to modify behavior. The discount faithful defected in droves, either to the retail branch of the church or to a dozen different pagan sects. Why not get pissed and dance naked around a pole all Sabbath if the worst of it was a rash on the naughty bits and the dropping of the odd bastard now and then? Pope Baldface was burned in a wicker man the next Beltane, and cats shat in his ashes. So, yes, a two-pope joke was untimely, but fuck all, it was dire times, and I sallied forth for a bit. So, the second pope says, "Your sister? I thought she was kosher." And no one laughed. Cordelia rolled her eyes and made a raspberry sound. The pathetic one-trumpet fanfare dribbled. The great doors were thrown open, and France and Burgundy pounced into the hall, followed by the bastard Edmund.
"Silence, fool," commanded Leah, with great superfluity. "Hail Burgundy! Hail France!"
"Hail Edmund, the bloody bastard," said I. Leah ignored me, and motioned for France and Burgundy to come before him. They were both fit, taller than me but not tall, a few years south of 30. Burgundy had dark hair and the sharp features of a Roman. France, sandy hair and softer features. Each wore sword and dagger that I doubted had ever been drawn but for ceremony. Fucking frogs.
"Lord Burgundy," said Leah, "you have rivaled for the hand of our youngest daughter. What dowry do you require for her?"
"No less than your highness has offered," said the dark pufter.
"Alas, that is no more, good Burgundy. What we offered was offered when she was dear to us. Now she has roused our anger and betrayed our love, and her dowry is nothing. If you want her as she is there, take her, but there will be no dowry."
Burgundy was stunned. He backed away, nearly stepping on France's feet.
"I'm sorry then, sir, but I must tend to property and power in my choice of duchess."
"She shall have neither," said Leah.
"So be it," said Burgundy. He nodded, bowed, and stepped back.
"I am sorry, Cordelia."
"No worry, sir," said the princess. "If Burgundy's heart is wed only to property and power, then it could never be to me truly. Peace be with you."
I breathed a half sigh of relief. We might be driven from our home, but if Cordelia was driven out with us...
"I'll take her," said Edgar.
"You will not, you blubbering, beetle-browed, dog-buggering dolt," I may have accidentally exclaimed.
"You will not," said Gloucester, pushing his son back into his seat.
"Well, I will have her," said the Prince of France.
for she is a dowry in herself.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Pocket, that's enough, said the king. Guard, take him outside and hold him until our will is done.
Two yeomen stepped up behind me and seized me under the armpits. I heard drool moan and looked over to see him cowering behind a column. This had never happened before. Nothing like it. I was the all-licensed fool. I, of all people, could speak truth to power. I am Chief Cheeky Monkey to the King of Bloody Britain.
You don't know what you're getting into, France. Have you seen her feet? Or perhaps that is your game. Put her to work in the vineyards, crushing wine grapes. Majesty, the pufter means to force servitude on her. Mark my words.
But no one heard the last of it. The yeoman had dragged me from the room and held me in the hall outside. I sought to brain one with Jones, but he caught the puppet stick and tucked him in his belt at the small of his back.
Sorry, Pocket, said Curran, the captain of the guard, a grizzled bear in chainmail who held me by my right arm. "'Twas a direct order, and you were fast cutting your throat with your own tongue.'
"'Not me,' said I. "'He wouldn't hurt me.'
"'I'd have said he'd not banish his best friend "'and disown his favourite daughter before this night. "'Hanging a fool's an easy leap, lad.'
"'Aye,' said I. "'You're right. "'Let me go, then.'
"'Not until the king's business is done,' said the old yeoman.
The doors came open, fanfare trickled anemic through the portal, and out came the Prince of France, on his arm Cordelia, radiant and wearing a grim smile. I could see her jaw clenched, but she relaxed when she saw me, and some of the fire of anger left her eyes.
"'So, you're off with the Frog Prince,' said I.
France laughed at that. "'Bloody buggering French fuck that he is.' Is there anything so irritating as a noble who actually behaves nobly? Yes, I am leaving, Pocket, but there is one thing you must always remember and never forget.
Both at once?
Shut up.
Aye, milady.
You must always remember, and you must never forget, that while you are the black fool, the dark fool, the royal fool, the all-licensed fool and the king's fool... You were not brought here to be those things. You were brought here to please me. Me! So when you put your titles aside, a fool shall still there reside. And now and forever, you are my fool.
Oh, my. You are going to do well in France. They hold unpleasantness to be a virtue.
Mine!
Now and forever, milady.
You may kiss my hand, fool. The yeoman released me, and I bent to take her hand. She pulled it away and turned, her gown fanning out around her as she walked away. Sorry, having you on.
I smiled into the floor. You bitch.
I'll miss you, Pocket,
she said over her shoulder, and she hurried down the corridor.
Take me with you. Take us both with you.
France, you could use a brilliant fool in a great lumbering bag of flatulence like drool, couldn't you?
The prince shook his head, entirely too much pity in his eyes for my tastes.
You are Lear's fool. With Lear you shall stay.
That's not what your wife just said.
She will learn, said the prince.
He turned on his heel and followed Cordelia down the corridor. I started after them, but the captain yanked me back by the arm.
Better go, lad.
Next, out of the hall, came the sisters and their husbands. Before I could say anything, the captain had clamped his hand over my mouth and was lifting me off my feet as I kicked. Cornwall made us to draw his dagger, but Regan pulled him away.
"'You've just won a kingdom, my duke. Killing vermin is a servant's task. Leave the bitter fool stew in his own bile.'
She wanted me. It was clear.
Goneril would not look me in the eye, but hurried past. And her husband, Albany, just shook his head as he walked by. 100 brilliant witticisms died, suffocating on the captain's heavy glove. Thus muted, I pumped my codpiece at the Duke and tried to force a fart, but my bum trumpet could find no note. As if the gods had sent down a dim and gaseous avatar to help me, Drool came next through the door, walking rather more straight than was his habit. Then I saw that someone had looped a rope around his neck, the noose fixed to a spear whose point was almost piercing Drool's throat. Edmund stepped into the corridor holding the other end of the spear, two men-at-arms flanking him.
"'The captain having a laugh with you then, Pocket?'
said Drool, innocent of his peril. "'The captain dropped me to my feet then, "'but held my shoulder to keep me from going at Edmund, "'whose father and brother passed behind him.
"'You are right, Pocket,' said Edmund, "'poking Drool a bit with the spear for emphasis. "'Killing you would be enough to cement my unfavourable position for ever. "'But a hostage. "'There's a mute I can use.' I so enjoyed your performance in there that I prevailed upon the king to provide me with a fool of my own. And look at his gift. He'll be coming to Gloucester with us to assure that you don't forget your promise.
You don't need the spear, bastard. He'll go if I ask him.
Are we going on holiday, Pocket?
Asked Drool, blood beginning to trickle down his neck then. I approached the giant. No, lad, said I. You're going to go with the bastard here. Do as he says. I turned to the captain. Give me your knife. The captain eyed Edmund and the men-at-arms beside him who had hands on hilts.
I don't know, Pocket. Give me your bloody knife.
I whirled, pulled the knife from the captain's belt, and before the men-at-arms could draw, I'd cut the rope around Drool's neck and pushed Edmund's spear aside.
You don't need the spear, bastard.
I handed the captain his knife and motioned for Drool to bend down so we were eye to eye. I want you to go with Edmund and don't give him any trouble. You understand?
Aye. You ain't coming?
I'll be along. I've business at the White Tower first.
Shagging to be done.
Drool nodded so enthusiastically you could nearly hear his tiny brain rattling around his gourd.
I'll be helping, right?
No, lad. But you'll have your own castle. You'll be the proper fool, won't you? There'll be all kinds of hiding and listening, Drool. Do you understand what I'm saying, lad? I winked, hoping against hope that the git would get my meaning.
Will there be heinous fuckery, Pocket?
Aye. I think you can count on it.
Smashing!
Drool clapped his hands and danced a little jig then, chanting,
"'Heinous fuckery, most foul! Heinous fuckery, most foul!'
I looked to Edmund. "'You've my word, bastard. "'But you've also my word that if any harm comes to the natural, "'I'll see to it that ghosts ride in your grave.' A flash of fear showed in Edmund's eye then, but he fought it down and affected his usual swaggering smirk.
"'His life is on your word, little man.'
The bastard turned and strutted down the corridor. Drool looked back, a big tear welling in his eye as he realised what was happening. I waved him on.
"'I'd have taken the other two if you'd dirked him,' said Curran. The other guard nodded in agreement. "'The evil bastard was asking for it.'
"'Well, now you fucking tell me,' said I.
Another guard hurried out of the hall then, and seeing it was only the fool with his captain, reported,
"'Captain!' The king's food taster. He's dead, sir.
Three friends had I. Six. Friendship and the Odd Bonk. Life is loneliness, broken only by the gods taunting us with friendship and the Odd Bonk. I admit it. I grieved. Perhaps I am a fool to have expected Cordelia to stay.
Well, yes, I am a fool.
Don't be overly clever, eh? It's annoying. But for most of my manly years, she had been the lash on my back, the bait to my loins, and the balm of my imagination. My torment, my tonic, my fever, my curse. I ache for her. There is no comfort in the castle. Drool gone, Taster gone, Leah gone mad. At best, Drool was little more company than Jones, and decidedly less portable. But I worry for him, great child that he is, stumbling about in the circle of so many villains and so much sharp metal. I miss his gape-toothed smile, filled as it was with forgiveness, acceptance, and often cheddar.
And Taster? What did I know of him, really? Just a wan lad from Hog Nostril on Thames. Yet when I needed a sympathetic ear, he provided, even if he was oft distracted from my woes by his own selfish dietary concerns.
I lay on my bed in the Porter's Lodge, staring out the cruciform arrow loops at the grey bones of London, stewing in my misery, yearning for my friends, for my first friend, for Talia, the Anchoress. On a chill autumn day at Dog Snogging, the third time I was allowed to bring food to the Anchoress, we became fast friends. I was still in awe of her, and merely being in her presence made me feel base, unworthy and profane, but in a good way. I passed the plate of rough brown bread and cheese through the cross in the wall, with prayers and a plea for her forgiveness. "This fare will do, Pocket, it will do. I'll forgive you for a song. You must be a most pious lady and have great love for the Lord. The Lord is a tosser. I thought the Lord was a shepherd. Well, that too. But a bloke needs hobbies. Do you know Greensleeves?
I know Donna Nobis Patchum.
Do you know any pirate songs?
I could sing Donna Nobis Patchum like a pirate.
It means give us peace in Latin, doesn't it?
Aye, mistress.
Bit of a stretch then, innit? A pirate singing give us bloody peace.
I suppose. I could sing you a psalm then, mistress.
All right then, Pocket. A psalm it is. One with pirates and loads of bloodshed, if you have it.
I was nervous, desperate for approval from the Anchoress, and afraid that if I displeased her, I might be struck down by an avenging angel, as seemed to happen often in Scripture. Try as I might, I could not recall any piratey psalms. I cleared my throat and sang the only psalm I knew in English. The Lord is my tosser, I shall not want.
Wait, 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 said the Anchoress. Doesn't it go, the Lord is my shepherd?
Well, yes, mistress, but you said...
And she started to laugh.
It was the first time I heard her truly laugh, and it felt as if I was getting approval from the Virgin herself. In the dark chamber, just the single candle on my side of the cross, it seemed like her laughter was all around me, embracing me.
Oh, Pocket, you are a love. Thick as a bloody brick, but such a love.
I could feel the blood rise in my face. I was proud and embarrassed and ecstatic all at once. I didn't know what to do, so I fell to my knees and prostrated myself before the arrow loop, pushing my cheek against the stone floor.
I'm sorry, mistress.
She laughed some more.
Arise, Sir Pocket of Dog Snogging.
I climbed to my feet and stared into the dark cross-shaped hole in the wall, and there I saw that dull star that was her eye reflecting the candle flame, and I realized that there were tears in my own eyes.
Why did you call me that?
Because you make me laugh, and you are deserving and valiant. I think we're going to be very good friends. I started to ask her what she meant, but the iron latch clanked and the door into the passageway swung slowly open. Mother Basil was there, holding a candelabra, looking displeased.
Pocket, what's going on here? Said the Mother Superior in her gruff baritone.
Nothing, Reverend Mother. I've just given food to the Anchoress.
Mother Basil seemed reluctant to enter the passageway, as if she was afraid to be in view of the arrow loop that looked into the Anchoress's chamber.
Come along, Pocket. It's time for evening prayers.
I bowed quickly to the Anchoress and hurried out the door under Mother Basil's arm. As the sister closed the door, the Anchoress called,
Reverend Mother, a moment, please.
Mother Basil's eyes went wide, and she looked as if she'd been called out by the devil.
Go on to Vespers, Pocket. I'll be along.
She made her way into the dead-end passageway and closed the door behind her, even as the bell calling us to Vespers began to toll. I wondered what the Anchoress would discuss with Mother Basil. Perhaps some conclusion she had realized during her hours of prayer. Perhaps I'd been found wanting, and she would ask that I not be sent to her again. After just making my first friend, I was sorely afraid of losing her. While I repeated the prayers in Latin after the priest, in my heart I prayed to God not to take my Anchoress away. And when Mass ended, I stayed in the chapel and prayed until well after the midnight prayers. Mother Basil found me in the chapel.
There are going to be some changes, Pocket.
I felt my spirit drop into my shoe soles.
Forgive me, Reverend Mother, for I know not what I do.
What are you on about, Pocket? I'm not scolding you. I'm adding duties to your devotion.
Oh, said I.
From now on, you are to take food and drink to the Anchoress in the hour before Vespers. And there in the outer chamber shall you sit until she has eaten. But upon the bell for Vespers you are to leave there and not return until the next day. No longer than an hour shall you stay. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am. But why only the hour?
More than that, and you will interfere with the Anchoress's own communion with God. Further, you are never to ask her about where she was before this, about her family, or her past in any way. If she should speak of these things, you are to immediately put your fingers in your ears and verily sing, "La, la, 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 I can't hear you, I can't hear you," and leave the chamber immediately.
I can't do that, Mum.
Why not?
I can't work the latch to the outer door with my fingers in my ears.
Ah, sweet Pocket, I do so love your wit. I think you shall sleep on the stone floor this night. The rug shields you from the blessed cooling of your fevered imagination, which God finds an abomination. Yes, a light beating and the bare stone for you and your wit tonight.
Yes, Mum.
And so, you must never speak with the Anchoress about her past, and if you should, you shall be excommunicated and damned for all eternity with no hope for redemption. The light of the Lord shall never fall upon you, and you shall live in darkness and pain for ever and ever. And in addition, I shall have Sister Bambi feed you to the cat.
Yes, Mum, said I. I was so thrilled I nearly peed. I would be blessed by the glory of the Anchoress every single day. Well, that's a scaly spot of snake wank, said the Anchoress.
No, Mum, it's a cracking big cat.
Not the cat, the hour a day. Only an hour a day. Mother Basil doesn't want me to disturb your communion with God, Madam Anchoress. I bowed before the dark arrow loop. Call me Talia.
I daren't, Mum. And neither may I ask you about your past or from whence you come. Mother Basil has forbidden it.
She's right on that, but you may call me Talia, as we are friends.
Aye, Mum. Talia.
And you may tell me of your past, good Pocket. Tell me of your life.
But dog-snogging is all I know, all I have ever known.
I could hear her laughing in the dark.
Then tell me a story from your lessons, Pocket.
So I told the Anchoress of the stoning of St. Stephen, of the persecution of St. Sebastian, and the beheading of St. Valentine, and she, in turn, told me stories of the saints I had never heard of in catechism.
And so, said Talia, that is the story of how St. Rufus of Pipe Wrench was licked to death by marmots.
That sounds a most horrible martyring, said I.
Aye, said the Anchoress, for marmot spit is the most noxious of all substances, and that is why St. Rufus is the patron of saliva and halitosis unto this day. Enough martyring. Tell me of some miracles.
And so I did. I told of the magic self-filling milk pail of St. Bridget of Kildare, of how St. Fillan, after his ox was killed by a wolf, was able to compel the same wolf to pull a cart full of materials for building a church, and how St. Patrick drove the snakes out of Ireland.
Aye, said Talia. And snakes have been grateful ever since. But let me apprise you of the most wondrous miracle of how St. Cinnamon drove the Marsders out of Swindon.
I've never heard of St. Cinnamon, said I.
Well, that is because these nuns at Dog Snogging are base, and not worthy to know such things. And why you must never share what you learn here with them, lest they become overwhelmed and succumb to an ague.
An ague of over-piety?
Aye, lad. And you would be the one to have killed them.
Oh, I would never want to do that.
Of course you wouldn't. Did you know, in Portugal they canonize a saint by actually shooting him out of a cannon?
And so it went, day in, day out, week in, week out, trading secrets and lies with Talia. You might think that it was cruel of her to spend her only time in contact with the outside world telling lies to a little boy. But then, the first story that Mother Basil had told me was about a talking snake who gave tainted fruit to naked people, and the bishop had made her an abbess. All along, what Talia was teaching me was how to entertain her, how to share a moment in story and laughter, how you could become close to someone even when separated from them by a stone wall. Once a month, for the first 2 years, the bishop came from York to check on the Anchoress, and she would seem to lose her spirit for a day, as if he were skimming it off and taking it away. But soon she would recover, and our routine of chat and laughter would go on. After a few years, the bishop stopped coming, and I was afraid to ask Mother Basil why. Lest it be a reminder, and the dour prelate resume his spirit-sucking sojourns. The longer the Anchoress was in her chamber, the more she delighted in my conveying the most mundane details from the outside.
"Tell me of the weather today, Pocket. Tell me of the sky, and don't skip a single cloud."
Well, the sky looked like someone was catapulting giant sheep into the frosty eye of God.
"Fucking winter. Crows against the sky?"
"Aye, Talia, like a vandal with quill and ink set loose to randomly punctuate the very dome of the day."
"Ah, well spoken, love. Completely incoherent imagery."
"Thank you, mistress." While about my chores and studies, I tried to take note of every detail and construct metaphors in my head so I might paint word pictures for my Anchoress, who depended on me to be her light and colour. My days seemed to begin at 4 when I came to Talia's chamber and end at 5 when the bell rang for vespers. Everything before was in preparation for that hour, and everything after, until sleep, was in sweet remembrance. The Anchoress taught me how to sing, not just the hymns and chants I had been singing from the time I was little, but the romantic songs of the troubadours. With simple, patient instruction, she taught me how to dance, juggle, and perform acrobatics, and all by verbal description. Not once in those years had I laid eyes on the Anchoress, or seen more than her partial profile at the arrow loop. I grew older, and fuzz sprouted on my cheek. My voice broke, making me sound as if a small goose was trapped in my gullet, honking for her supper. The nuns at dog-snogging started to take notice of me as something other than their pet, for many were sent to the abbey when they were no older than I. They would flirt and ask me for a song, a poem, a story. The more bawdy, the better. And the Anchoress had taught me many of those. Where she had learned them, she would never say. "Were you an entertainer before you became a nun?"
"No, Pocket, and I am not a nun."
"But perhaps your father..."
"No, my father was not a nun either."
"I mean, was he an entertainer?"
"Sweet Pocket, you mustn't ask about my life before I came here. What I am now, I have always been, and everything I am is here with you."
"Sweet Talia," said I, "that is a fiery flagon of dragon toss."
"Isn't it, though?"
"You're grinning, aren't you?" She held the candle close to the arrow loop, illuminating her wry smile. I laughed and reached through the cross to touch her cheek. She sighed, took my hand and pressed it hard against her lips. Then, in an instant, she had pushed my hand away and moved out of the light.
"Don't hide," said I. "Please don't hide."
"Fat lot of choice I have about whether I hide or not. I live in a bloody tomb." I didn't know what to say. Never before had she complained about her choice to become the Anchoress of dog-snogging, even if other expressions of her faith seemed, well, abstract. "I mean, don't hide from me. Let me see you."
"You want to see? You want to see?"
I nodded.
"Give me your candles."
She had me hand 4 lit candles through the arrow loop. Whenever I performed for her, she had me set them in holders around the outer chamber so she could see me dance or juggle or do acrobatics. But never had she asked for more than 1 candle in her own chamber. She placed the candles around her chamber, and for the first time I could see the stone pallet where she slept on a mattress of straw, her meager possessions laid out on a heavy table, and Talia, standing there in a tattered linen frock.
"Look,"
she said. She pulled her frock over her head and dropped it on the floor. She was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. She looked younger than I had imagined, thin but womanly. Her face was that of a mischievous Madonna, as if carved by a sculptor inspired more by desire than the divine. Her hair was long and the colour of buckskin, catching the candlelight as if a single ray of sunlight might make it explode in golden fire. I felt a heat rise in my face, and another kind of rise in my trousers. I was excited and confused and ashamed all at once, and I turned my back on the arrow loop and cried out, "No!" Suddenly she was right behind me, and I felt her hand on my shoulder, then rubbing my neck.
"Pocket, sweet Pocket, don't.
It's all right." I feel like the devil and the virgin are doing battle in my body. "I didn't know you were like that."
"Like a woman, you mean?"
Her hand was warm and steady, kneading the muscles in my shoulder through the cross in the wall, and I leaned into it. I wanted to turn and look. I wanted to run out of the chamber. I wanted to be asleep, or just waking, ashamed that the devil had visited me in the night with a damp dream of temptation. You know me, Pocket. I'm your friend. But you are the Anchoress. I'm Talia, your friend who loves you. Turn around, Pocket. And I did. Give me your hand, said she.
And I did.
She put it on her body, and she put her hands on mine, and pressed against the cold stone, through the cross in the wall, I discovered a new universe, of Talia's body, of my body, of love, of passion, of escape. And it was a damn sight better than bloody chance and juggling. When the bell rang for Vespers, we fell away from the cross, spent and gasping, and we began to laugh. Oh, and I had chipped a tooth. One for the devil, then, love, said Talia. When I arrived with the Anchoress's supper the next afternoon, she was waiting with her face pressed nearly through the center of the arrow cross. She looked like one of the angel-faced gargoyles that flanked the main doors of Dog Snogging, except they always seemed to be weeping, and she was grinning. So, didn't go to confession today, did you? I shuddered. No, Mum. I work in the scriptorium most of the day. Pocket, I think I would prefer you not call me Mum, if it's not too much to ask. Given the new level of our friendship, it seems, oh, I don't know, unsavoury. Yes, mistress. Mistress I can work with. Now, pass me my supper and see if you can fit your face in the opening the way that I have. Talia's cheekbones were wedged in the arrow loop, which was a little wider than my hand. Doesn't that hurt? I'd been finding abrasions on my arms and various bits all day from our adventure the night before. It's not the flaying of St. Bart, but yes, it stings a bit. You can't confess what we did or what we do, love. You know that, right? Then am I going to have to go to hell? Well, she pulled back, rolled her eyes as if searching the ceiling for an answer. Not alone. Give us our supper, lad, and get your face in the loop. I have something to teach you. And so it went for weeks and months. I went from being a mediocre acrobat to a talented contortionist, and Talia seemed to regain some of the life that I had thought sure she'd lost. She was not holy in the sense that the priests and nuns taught, but she was full of spirit and a different kind of reverence, more concerned with this life, this moment, than an eternity beyond the reach of the cross in the wall. I adored her, and I wanted her to be out of the chamber, in the world, with me, and I began to plan her escape. But I was but a boy, and she was bloody barking, so it was not meant to be.